like relating to symmetry algebras of different dimensions, and then like what that can tell you about like the corresponding field theories. So I think like for me as a mathematician, like that was like the first useful trick I learned, and like you can already read off a lot of things just from, like you can already make a lot of conjectures as a mathematician just from knowing like these very simple things. So what I want to do really quickly is just for a second, because I just want to go ahead and review C's talk. I don't want to spend a ton of time on it because he did a really good job, but I'm going to use different notation for my supersymmetry algebra than he used, and so I just want to establish, So I want to start with the 2D, n equals 2, supersymmetry algebra. And I'm going to try and write it down, I'm going to write it down in kind of a weird way. But it'll make sense why I'm doing this. So I'm going to complexify everything. And so what do we learn from this? What can we do with this? So the complexified version of the spin group is just a C star. And then there were two C stars that C was calling L and R. But I actually want to write the algebra down with a different R symmetry group, or with a different way of breaking up these C stars. This is the R symmetry that C wrote down. And then he showed that you have, this is my spin. And then he showed that this all acted on a 2D vector representation multiplied by this odd piece, which, since it was two-dimensional supersymmetry, you needed to choose two-dimensional vector spaces and then tensor them with the spin reps in 2D. And then in order to actually write down the commutator relation that lets you take these odd elements and take their commutators in order to get various kinds of translations, if you remember from Chris's talk, he said that you actually need to pick an inner product on both of these algebras. On both of these vector spaces, so that my inner product be this weird one. So basically it pairs E1 and E2, but it's null on E1 squared. It's just polarized. Yeah, just polarize it. It's going to be a little bit easier to write things down in this way.
The inner product is on each C2?
Sorry?
The inner product is on each individual.
Yeah, that's right, because when you're doing this 2D algebra, remember that this is just a copy of C, where your spin representation is acting with either weight plus a half or weight minus a half. And then this vector representation splits as a copy of C where you have weight 1 and another copy of C where you have weight minus 1. And in order to produce an element of this vector space, you need to pair either two things in S plus to get something here, or two things in S minus in order to get something here. And in order to know what you're going to do with this vector space part of it, you need to have some way of taking two elements of this vector space and producing a scalar. And so that is given by this inner product that I have here. So so this lets us go ahead and write down our supercharges. So if
then, sorry, CA and CB are acting.
Yeah, oh, sorry, so let me say how these things are acting. So there's an action of a different C star on this that preserves this inner product, or on C2 preserving this inner product, that gives one of these factors weight 1 and the other factor weight minus 1. Or actually, sorry, plus a half or minus a half, is what I meant to say. But the point is they have to act negatively, or sorry, positively, in order to preserve this inner product. And then this one is going to be diagonal. And this one is going to be the anti-diagonal. So what I mean by that is, right, I have a copy of this C star acting on both of these C2s. And so I can either take the diagonal part or the anti-diagonal part. And these were the two and then these were the two C star. So then when C was writing down his twisting homomorphisms, he produced homomorphisms from the spin group into the R symmetry. And the two different embeddings, like A and B, the way that I've split things up, it's just C star maps to C star A or C star maps to C star B, whereas he sort of had to write things down with the diagonal and anti-diagonal. But I think it's going to be easier if I do things in this way. And then one can write down the supercharges in the following way. So you can write them down by basically giving their weight under the spin, which is either a plus or a minus half. So I'll just record the sign. And so that tells you whether your supercharge is in here or in here. And then you can also give the two weights under under the diagonal or the anti-diagonal. So you can write, maybe we'll say it, so you can write it like this. Although this kind of over-specifies, things, because it makes it look like you would have four options here, but you really don't. They have to be, if you're in this factor, they have to multiply to plus one. So, so there's actually like a constraint here that tells you that you've really only got four things, not the full eight that you might think you have. But the reason that I'm doing it this way is because when I try and compare it to 3D n equals 4, it'll be a lot easier.
So at C star, the A twist was the diagonal action.
Yeah, but basically C, when he wrote down, he had like Qs and Q bars.
Yeah.
And then he had it acting like negatively on the Q bars and positively on the Qs.
Yeah.
And like I have it swapped.
Okay. So I think one of the main problems today was to
variables. Yes. Yeah, that's true. So anyway, so like I've just like written it down in a slightly different way because I'm going to try and embed it. Okay. And so then in this notation, C found that you had two topological twists. And they both look like they both have one charge in common. So I think that in his notation, this was the one that was called Q bar minus. And then you added on one extra piece, depending on whether you wanted to get the A twist or the B twist. And so you notice that this one is special. It's fixed under both of these C stars. If you make your R symmetry be either the combination of this and its opposite or this and its opposite, then this thing will be fixed under either of those C stars. To realize I should have like introduced a global line sign, but I made a mistake. So whenever you have these being opposite, it's fixed under the combination of the SO2 and the first symmetry. And if you do it in the other way, then it's fixed. And then the fact that these two add up to the opposite tell you that it's fixed under the combination of the spin 2 and the opposite of this symmetry. For a second, and this symmetry. No, I did do it by mistake. So it's fixed under both of those two copies. And that charge appears in both of these twisting homomorphisms. And then you need to find one other guy, and he's supposed to be fixed under the combination of spin and the appropriate symmetry. So can you guys tell me what I'm supposed to get, just in order to make sure that I
did this right?
So I'll give you a hint. There's supposed to be a plus on either side. And now what are my two options if I want things to be fixed under the A or under the B? Just to make sure that you guys understand what I'm writing.
Like plus minus or plus plus?
Yeah, so minus plus or plus plus.
So your rule was there's three signs, they have to multiply to minus one.
Yeah.
And then you say either the first, like the bottom has to be different from one of the top two.
Sorry, can you just say, one more time, the first one, like the Q minus plus plus, your like upper left corner there, that's fixed under what?
So Q minus plus plus is fixed under the combination of my SO2.
Yes.
And my, and either C star A or C star B, because the signs are opposite. Right, because like basically this thing, it's because it's with one of the groups it's acting with charge minus a half.
Yeah.
And if you combine it with the fact that the other group is acting by charge plus a half,
right, cool.
Then you get zero. Okay. And then because either it works with either one of these ways, it works with either spin 2 plus this guy, we'll fix it.
Okay, whereas the one you just wrote down, that one is fixed by only the A guy.
That's correct.
Together with spin.
That's correct, yeah.
And then same for the B.
Does that make sense? Sorry, I just wanted to go through this in like excruciating detail because it's confusing, or the notation is confusing, and that's my fault. And but also because the same notation is gonna like continue to appear. In further examples, and I just wanted to fix it once and for all. So if you just write down this special guy that's fixed under both of these things, I claim that this is actually something that's called a holomorphic topological twist. The way that you figure this thing out is that I claim that the image of the bracket with QA is equal to all of V of 2D, which is also equal to the image of the bracket with QB. So this is an exercise. One thing that you can see is that if you take the image of the bracket with just QHT, that this is just one dimensional.
Just because it's 2D, maybe you want to say just holomorphic, right? Because
just holomorphic. It's going to get, so this thing is that. And so this one, so whatever is in the image of this guy, I'm going to treat as being like a DZ bar. And so if you look, so if you twist with respect to this charge, what'll happen is rather than getting a theory that's translation invariant, you'll just get one where none of your fields depend on Z bar. which means that everything's holomorphic. Okay, so any like questions about this? I'm sorry that like it seems like pretty.
If my theory was like a sigma model would target a Kähler manifold, does the holomorphically twisted thing have a name I'm familiar with? It's not the A twist or the B twist.
It's a half twist.
Half twist means
the what?
The half
twist. Okay, well, that's okay.
But, so but I mean, so like if you, yeah, so actually let me say something about the equations of motion for these three theories. This is also something that C told you. So one, so after twisting, one gets that the solutions to the equations of motion, so this is like in Phil's sense, is in the B twist is the easiest to describe.
Sorry, Justin, Natalie made a good comment. So the holomorphic twist you might want to point out is available even for 0, 2 theories.
Sure, because I only needed one, because I didn't need both. Yeah, I only needed one.
So you, even with less supersymmetry, one can use that, and it leads to the Chiral-Duran complex, and that sort of.
Yeah. So this HT twist ends up being a theory of maps from your curve Dolbeau, I guess this thing is also what C was calling it. So without the Durham differential. So to T star. This is your Kähler manifold. This B twist looks the same, so this is what C was actually talking about. So I'm writing these things down for a single model. With target eyes.
Just so we don't get confused, can you just call it H instead of HT since we're still in two dimensions?
Well, it just means half twist.
Okay, fine, whatever. No. That's going to confuse me later.
This one ends up being maps from sigma to rom. So this thing is this odd tangent bundle together with the Durham differential. With the super manifold. So like its underlying super manifold is the same as this. But then if you look at functions on this guy, it's the Durham complex of sigma without the just the forms that you add on the differential. That's the difference between these things, and similarly, it's T star from X. And then this A twist is a little bit harder to write down, again, this holomorphic setting. I claim that it looks something like so this is sort of like. And then you're going to twist this thing by the Poisson.
The B twist is better than what the contingent of X bar, X bar.
Sorry?
B twist.
So in this case, I'm using the convention that this is all happening in algebraic
geometry.
So inside of C's talk, he put on an extra copy of T star
the same as holomorphic of direct
integral. One of x, and then he attached the Dolbeau differential.
Yeah.
That just means treat x as an object in
yeah.
algebraic geometry, as opposed to an object in. So if you think of like what functions on this thing are, the functions are the Dolbeau complex.
So if I was already thinking of X as an object of algebraic geometry, was that like wrong for the first line? No, wait, that
yeah, so in C's talks, he was using X as an object of real geometry, and then he was saying, think of your sheaf of functions as being the zero, the Dolbeau forms, like the degree zero Dolbeau forms. And then add on.
But is that also in the first line or no? That each.
Yeah, so that's implicit in this.
Okay.
Both of these lines.
Okay. In all three of those lines? Or not in the. No, it shouldn't be in the A side, right?
Not in the A side.
Is that.
Comment on the difficulty at least? Like,
no. it's about like the A model like has instant on corrections,
yeah,
right? And so trying to study it in this way isn't very helpful, and I just want to skip it for a minute. Okay.
That's the homology.
This one?
Yes. So
that's above my pay grade. Like you need instant time corrections for the chiral complex.
It's in there. Is that line also suspicious? Or,
sorry?
Is that line also suspicious? Or?
I think this one's less suspicious.
Yeah, I mean, there are instant time corrections. It's just in a limit, they go away, I think. Yes.
Well, the chiral complex is the half twist only in the infinite volume limit when the instant time
correction. Exactly. And then that makes sense.
I see. Well, then this thing also, you could go to the infinite volume limit. Or do you want an infinite volume limit or like a small volume limit where all the instant times
yeah.
drop out of the
large volume
limit?
Yeah, you want to do the infinite volume limit where all the instant time corrections drop out of the Foucault category.
Great.
And you can study it in some way like this. But it's okay. So now I want to try. Like looking at the 3D n equals 4 supersymmetry algebra. And then all the bizarre things that I did will hopefully make a little bit more sense. So again, you're going to need something that's a copy of a spin group and an R symmetry. And then you'll have your 3D vector representation. Plus an odd piece, which is some vector space
called W3D, tensor vector spin representation. One. And in order for this thing to have a pairing, this thing needs a interval case. Okay, but before I tell you what that is, I need to tell you. I'm sorry. Let me also say that this is a four-dimensional vector space. So before I tell you what this metric form is going to be, let me tell you what this R symmetry group is going to be, because I'm going to choose a weird way of writing down. I mean, like, you know, a canonical four-dimensional vector space with an inner product, but I'm going to use a weird one in order to make this R symmetry manifest. Okay, so but first let me just go through. So after complexification, the spin group is just isomorphic to SL2. This is just the standard representation of SL2. It's helpful to write this thing down. So I need some three-dimensional representation such that this SL2 acts on it. And I want to have the pairing from S3D to V3D to be manifest. And so one way of writing this down is to actually just write this thing as a symmetric square of S3D, because that'll make the bracket visible. If I bracket two things, ignoring this for a minute, if I bracket two things in here, I would just take their product in the symmetric algebra. And then think of it as a translation.
Everything's complexified?
Everything's complexified. It's the same as before. Sorry, so, but this makes sense. And then now, I need to pick out what my R symmetry is going to be. And the R, turns out that the right R symmetry for this is two copies of SL2, which I will label by A and B, because in a minute we're going to try to relate them to this piece. Okay, so now I'm almost done writing down this algebra. But I need to actually pick out a four-dimensional vector space that needs that makes the R symmetry. Does that make sense? So I want some four-dimensional vector space that has these two actions of SL2. And so it has a symmetric form that's preserved by that action. One option is you take C2, label it by A, with its canonical symplectic form. And then I could tensor it with C2B. With its symplectic form. And then the product is going to be C2 tensor C2, but I claim that it will actually have that the tensor of W, of these two copies of W, I claim that this thing is a bilinear form, it's a symmetric form.
All you're doing right now is reminding me that SO4 is SO3 times SO3, and you're writing it half.
Because in order to, but like, because if you want to write anything down,
that. So is this the four-dimensional spin representation?
Sorry. No, it's the
four-dimensional
vector.
Okay, great. Thanks.
Yeah. So in a minute, we're going to see that this is actually. So as Theo said. There's a nice exceptional isomorphism between spin 4. Oh, I didn't push the button.
So what I was originally looking for was some four-dimensional vector space with an inner product. And it turns out that there's an exceptional isomorphism between these two groups. And I'm telling you how specifically to write it down. If you make this be your C4, then so does this so far make sense? So now let me go ahead and label guys here. So now we can label things similarly. We can label our supercharges in 3D. Yeah, so we can label our supercharges in 3D in exactly the same way. But now this labeling means something different, but then I'm going to tell you that things are actually compatible. So when I write things in this way, what you'll find is that this is E1, E alpha, insert some beta tensor, E gamma, where the lower, where I'm going to let the lower guy live in here. And then the upper guy. So that gives me an element of this threefold tensor product. And basically, you can read it off. Like you can know which element I mean by knowing how does it transform under like the torus of SL2. And then how does it transform under SL2A and how the torus in SL2A and how does it transform under the torus in SL2B? If you know those three weights, that uniquely determines the element in here. So these things are supposed to be weight vectors in the appropriate spaces. Does this make sense? Okay, let me, before I try to do anything else, can we just ensure, so how would I take the product of two of these guys? Let me just like fix one. Understand how this works. You guys try to tell me how I would figure this out. So first, let's figure out like how we write down the elements here. So the elements here are just supposed to be symmetric squares inside of this 3D algebra. So elements here just be written like E gamma prime, where it doesn't matter which direction you write them in.
So that one is plus minus.
Yeah, so this one would be, and so you could call this vector gamma prime or something like that.
Yeah.
And so this one would be B plus minus.
Minus.
Sorry?
Minus.
Minus.
Yeah, that's the order.
The order doesn't matter. It's a symmetric
pair. Just
symmetric.
Plus minus the other pair is symmetric pairing. So if you
I haven't used the symmetric pairing yet. Oh, you're telling me what the answer is going to be in the end. Yeah, and then in order to pair these, I need to apply the symplectic form to E plus E minus, and then also apply the symplectic form to E minus E plus, so that's like take these first guys, take their inner product and their product using the symplectic form, and then do the same to these guys. And in this case, so if your symplectic form is the standard dx dy, then
then yeah, these two things, well, these two things are all gonna have opposite signs, is the important part.
So
we're
gonna write a bracket around your cube.
You can take their product too, right? It's just half the bracket.
Yeah. So which one do you want to do?
Up to a factor of two. Like, I haven't decided whether I want it in or out. So I'm going to ignore all factors of two coming from whether I meant a bracket or a multiplication. They are the same up to a factor of two, and I'm too confused to write them down. Okay. So this, do people understand the way this works? It's a
little, it might be good to write it down in, like, full form, like with epsilon tensors.
Yeah, yeah,
and
epsilon tensors.
Maybe a Pauli matrix.
Yeah, so if I have, so I shouldn't need the Pauli matrix because I've sort of hidden it inside of this thing.
Yeah.
So this part is true, and then what you would need is epsilon. So let me do this in general. Just so that I can use slightly fewer letters, let me go ahead and start labeling these things by B's and B dots. It doesn't really matter. So yeah, so the first bit is easy. So you're just gonna get a vector labeled by gamma and mu inside of this symmetric square. E gamma times mu. And then the only interesting thing is the coefficient. And the way you figure that out is there's an you use the canonical anti-symmetric tensor, and you compare A and alpha and beta, and then you compare alpha dot and beta dot. And this is the general formula. Check out it. So this tensor is basically zero if they're the same. If it's like plus minus, it's one. If it's minus, plus minus. All right, and so now I want to try and relate these two things that we've done before. So let me get rid of these equations of motion. So this is a real pain, but everyone should do something like this once
in a while. Can you raise the other board for you?
No, I need this there.
No, the other board. What? Obviously.
I need all three of these.
Yeah, I want you to raise the other board. I want you to raise it.
Switch the two.
Switch the two.
Yes.
Thank you.
Okay. Sorry, I just thought that you wanted me to like erase a different one. It's visible.
No, sorry, not erase, raise. This is
yeah.
Okay. So it's clear.
So I claim that there's actually an embedding of the 3D n equals 2 algebra into the 3D n equals 4 algebra. So this thing is going to be almost entirely determined by the symmetry properties in this Lie algebra. So like, since we know like what symmetries everything has, we should like it should basically be forced upon us. So let's just try and like work things out one piece at a time. So I claim that, so first, the embedding on the spin groups is just the object form. Just as a maximal torus. Let's just make it be the standard maximal torus. This first half,
also called SO2 and SO3.
SO2 and SO3. It's the only option for spin 2 and spin 3 is really good.
the lift. Okay, and then now, the reason that I've written things in such a weird way is so that the R symmetry actions will embed in the same way. So this is embedded as the maximal torus here. This is embedded as the maximal torus. Okay, so everything is almost done. So we just need to do a few other things. So now we need to look at how the vector representation embeds. And since I've written this thing as the symmetric square of S3D, so this thing is spanned by guys E1, E plus, E minus, which is the same as E minus E plus, and then E minus E minus. And then now we need to figure out how we're going to embed this thing inside of here. But if we check our symmetry embedding, there's really only one choice. So what two-dimensional vector space instead of this three-dimensional vector space should I choose? Theo, you're not allowed to talk because you're slightly an expert. Oscar, you're allowed to talk, but you're not allowed to answer the previous comment. Is what I mean, because you're an expert. You're allowed to like tell me all the things I do wrong about, and all the things I could be doing better.
Can you handle us haggling you much to like?
I'm happy to be haggled, is what I'm saying. But you can't answer the Okay. So now like that's pretty good. And now we have our two copies. And now we have our odd piece. And now we have C2 tensor S3D, which is another C2. And the thing that's going to tell us what to do here is that this representation, what happens to it when I restrict the standard representation along this embedding? Yeah, so it splits. And this thing splits as a copy of the 2D plus and the 2D minus.
Those are just by weight spaces.
Those are just by weight spaces. And so now, like it's almost clear like what has to happen. It's clear that on this factor, like what has to happen. But now we need to figure out what's happening with these guys. And that's going to be, that's determined by exactly this R symmetry embedding. So what we want to do is we want to embed these things in such a way that the R symmetry action is preserved. So let's like think about like what happens to an element here. So the elements here are either of the form E plus tensor E plus or E minus tensor E plus. And so let's figure out how I was writing those things before. And the way that, and actually the way that I was writing these things before was exactly to make this embedding be true. So let's actually like try and like derive how I figured out how to write these things down in the other way. So what we want to have
is we want the first in, so we know that this is going to a plus here and a plus here. And then we want the first index of this thing to be the action, or the anti-diagonal, to read off like how things transform under the anti-diagonal. And the second one is supposed to read off how it transforms under the diagonal symmetry, right? So this one would transform under the anti-diagonal as a plus, and then under the diagonal, sorry, as a minus, and then under the diagonal as a plus. This one would transform as a plus minus. But then these guys actually are a little different. So when you work them out, I want to send this thing to something that has the same charge under the anti-diagonal. That would be a minus. And under the second factor, the diagonal and the anti-diagonal act the same. This one would go to plus minus minus. So my anti-diagonal is acting negatively here and positively here. Is the convention I chose. So it flips the things on the first factor if you have a plus, or it leaves things alone. Does this make sense?
Can you just give me a little summary?
All of the indices that were before get mapped into the exact same indices.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, that's why I wrote it down in this bizarre way. Right, so in the other kind of index, I was writing this thing to be E plus, or E minus, tensor E plus, tensor E plus. This thing was E plus, tensor E minus, tensor E plus, in the 3D stuff. And so my ridiculous notation in 2D was exactly designed. It's reasonable notation in 3D. My ridiculous notation in 2D was exactly designed to make the embedding work out. And the reason that you know that it has to be so good is that like these things are just enough, like these elements are completely determined by their transformation properties. So like once you know the transformation properties, you know what the map is, like on the scalars. Okay, so then now there's an exercise. Check the commutation relations. So just a word, in order to do this, you have to compare the weird inner product that I put here with the weird inner product that I put here. And I claim that I wrote down these really weird inner products exactly to make this easy to do. Okay. All right, so what did I learn from this? Actually, let me also like write down a corollary.
Wait, raise the other board.
No, raise the board you just wrote on. Come on, put it up.
Was it like the number of equivariant embeddings of the odd part? The odd part for 3 that's unique up the scalars?
Sorry?
The final conclusion was like mapping the odd part into the odd part in an equivariant way was unique up the scalars.
Yeah.
Just one scalar.
No. In the end, it's just going to be. Sorry, I'm actually not even. No, I doubt it's unique up to scalars. I'm not sure exactly how unique it is. I mean, it's certainly not. I guess once I fix this SO2, maybe it's pretty unique. But like a priori, right, if you had a three-dimensional space, you could pick the two-dimensional plane in like a lot of different ways.
Yeah.
And so like there's at least like that much symmetry. Like,
becomes at least like a, you know, a few months worth.
Well, I mean, you have to choose a maximal torus in SL2.
Yeah, and that determines the maximal torus there. So like, I, like, yeah, so once I fix that freedom,
yeah,
then I'm not sure how.
Okay, you can also choose maximal tori of SL2A and B to embed it.
Yeah, I've done that.
So you have like three different tori you can choose.
Yeah, so I've chosen.
And each one will be.
No, well, okay.
Conveniently, all maximal tori are country. So this is not actually a choice.
Yes.
Yeah, no, I
like. Yeah, so again, he's.
the choice is a meaning.
Yeah.
I mean, in SL2A and B, that choice is a choice.
Well, it's a choice of the complex structure. Yeah.
On Higgs and Coulomb branches, and. Okay.
Well, the choice doesn't mean because you already secretly chose a maximal torus somewhere else in your paper. But, like, we haven't gotten there yet. And so, like, a pair of maximal tori has a lot of meaning. A single maximal torus has no meaning.
So, I both agree and think it is important to think of that choice as a complex structure. You may also like to say that all complex structures are equivalent, which is fine, but it's then important to know that you've actually chosen one when you define this choice.
Definitely not.
I mean, nothing I've said here, like, I can't say that with anything.
Sorry.
Tudor's comment is true, but also totally non-obvious given what you know so far. Okay. So now, let's see, like, what else did we learn from this?
So, corollary. All these supercharges embed into 3D. I have a Lie algebra homomorphism. These things were some square zero elements that I had in the 2D, in the 2D n equals 2 algebra. Now I just got a bunch of things. Sorry, I had them in this 2D algebra. And now I just got a bunch of things in the 3D algebra, just for free via this embedding. And the twisting homomorphisms that you want to use are the obvious ones. So I had, before, C was using C stars embedding into either C star A or C star B, and I wanted to do my SL2s embedding into either SL2A or SL2B, and I'll transform in exactly like the right things. Okay, so now let me tell you, so that's why I did this in this ridiculous way. Okay, so exercise. Compute the image of the commutator subset inside of the So just like last time, like you can ask, like, how many translations do I get after commuting with the supercharge? How many translations are going to get killed when I twist by this element? So like what you could do is you could just try and compute like what that number is for these three charges. And I claim that the answer is going to be three, and then this one is going to be two. Is going to be those dimensions. So these two are going to give me fully topological trees. And this one is going to give me, so I can use one of these things to kill like a topological direction completely, or like one direction and make it topological. And then I can use the other one as a DZ bar. So I can make this thing be a holomorphic topological twist. All right, so now we know some of the twists, the twists of 3D n equals 1. So any questions about this? Okay, let me make just
just a comment, and then I'll move on to like something more interesting.
Wait, so I have a question. So you said you could use one of the twists to make something topological, and then use the other twist to say t-bar. Could you use each of those to make something topological, so you get a theory that's topological in two directions, and then just like...
In ordinary quantum
mechanics. In some sense, a holomorphic topological twist is topological in z-bar direction.
Okay.
Yeah, but it is true that like, so like there are some papers like Matt Willimore wrote, where like usually the game that I like to play is like do things like reduce on something that's like topological in the topological direction, and then you end up with something like kind of holomorphic in the other, like when you're done. But you could choose to like reduce in like different ways, and they get like a full quantum mechanics. Like you could choose to. You could choose to have a theory that's defined on like a topological surface times R, where R is like thought of as like having like a fully interesting theory in that direction. And then you could compactify along that topological surface, and then you would get some interesting one-dimensional quantum mechanics, which isn't topological at all. That's a thing you can do. And like Matt says that he does that sometimes.
Cool.
So that's the thing. So let me give one other exercise, which I thought I would do for you, but I think it's maybe would be too boring. So look up the 3D n equals 4 algebra, and then show 3D n equals 4. Embed 2, 4D n equals 4. So you don't know that algebra. Like one can, I mean, but Chris told you enough to write down the 4D supersymmetry algebra. And like one could go through a similar exercise, just like the one I did for 2D and 3D, and you can prove 3D algebra embeds into the 4D algebra. Again, just like Theo said, I was here in order to do things, I was using some exceptional isomorphisms, like the one between spin 4 and SL2 times SL2. To do this exercise, you will need some exceptional isomorphisms with spin 6. You'll need spin 6 is SL4 in order to do. And then you'll need to know the embedding of spin 3 into spin 4. Or sorry, spin 3 into spin 6. Yeah.
Comment. I think if one classifies nilpotent supercharges in the 3D n equals 4 algebra, one finds that the only choices are either A or B type topological twists or lots and lots of holomorphic topological twists. Those are the only options for nilpotent. There is another thing that people do, I think including Matt has thought about, which is to take a supercharge that is not nilpotent but squares to a translation in one direction. And you can sort of force yourself to work in the cohomology of that by only looking at field configurations or operators that are constant in that third direction. So there are no local operators in the cohomology of this thing, but there are line operators. And some people might also think of that as a dimensional uplift of a topological twist in 2D. So there are papers that talk about like the three-dimensional A twist and mean that thing. It has much less richness than the honest nilpotent supercharges of three dimensions, whose cohomology does have local operators and...
Yeah, so I wasn't claiming exhaustiveness, although, but these are the ones that are the most interesting to mathematicians at the moment. Okay, so but before I do this, any questions about like this weird computation before I go on to like something slightly more interesting? Although maybe I don't have any...
Yeah, it's already 5.
Okay, then let me say one word about what does this bite? Because I taught you how to do a computation, but I haven't taught you what it buys you. And I'm just gonna, since it's my last thing I'm gonna talk about, I'm just gonna use this board. So I won't be able to raise it.
It's okay, I forgive you.
Thank you. I just wanted to get your permission instead of having to ask for forgiveness at the end.
So what does this buy you?
So, in Davide's lectures, he sort of was telling you about boundary conditions for 2D n equals 2, or sorry, 2D n equals 2, 2. And he was showing, and I hope he showed, I wasn't there, sorry about that, that they were related to the topological quantum mechanics that Matt studied for either, he wrote down like Hermitian and Riemannian quantum mechanics. And the fact that the boundary conditions in 2D are related to those quantum mechanics is explained by some embedding of the supersymmetry algebras. Similarly, like what this thing has told us is if you want to study boundary conditions well, one good class is those that preserve two D n equals 2, 2 at the boundary. So like the picture you should have in mind is you have this 3D equals 4 theory in the bulk. And then here, like when you want to study what kind of a one thing, one option of what you could put on the boundary is in 2D n equals 2, 2 theory. And then this computation that I was doing sort of tells you, is supposed to tell you like how it's like, is going to be one thing that you'll need to analyze in order to tell you how these two things are supposed to be related. Mathematically, and so maybe if I did a good enough job that Phil gives me another chance to talk, mathematically, this tells you that there ought to be relations between 3D n equals 4 theories and things that mathematicians are used to studying, like ordinary mirror symmetry is one thing you can learn about like by using 3D n equals 4 theories. You can also use these things to learn things about like quantum cohomology, etc. So like what this does is like if you analyze this relationship, you could come up with a lot of different conjectures about like how these two theories are supposed to be related, and those give you like things that you could try and prove mathematically. And if I have a chance, maybe I'll tell you some of those later. Or I'll tell you some about 3D and 4D. I hope this wasn't too...
Questions.
Should we raise this point?
Can you see it on the board?
Good.
Okay.